AT&T Radio wants to know what you really think. From COVID-19, the Ukraine conflict, the persecution of Julian Assange, corrupt government, the WEF, digital IDs and digital currency, the Great Reset, the disassembling of the West, and the destruction of the world as we once knew it. Your opinion matters. It's time to get on our soapbox and tell us what you really think at TNTRadio.live. Upload a video, some audio, or drop us a note on TNT Radio's soapbox. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's news talk, TNT Radio. This is McBride and Brennan with David McBride and Dr. Robert Brennan on today's news talk, TNT. TNT Radio.
Yes, TNT, and this is McBride and Brennan. That's David McBride and yours truly, Robert Brennan. And David, you've been boxing this week.
Well, it was very good. I loved it. Very, very good on the, up at Surfers Paradise. There was a lot of people there.
Yeah.
And all different ages. I wasn't the oldest one in the boxing ring by any means. Uh-huh. There was a 77-year-old.
Wow. So our very special guest of the week is former Detective Chief Inspector Peter Fox. Now, Peter Fox had a 36-year-long history with the New South Wales Police Force, during which time he investigated multiple, we could say almost countless episodes or allegations of child sexual abuse in the Hunter region of New South Wales, and this involved certain members of the Catholic Church. And that's pertinent because that led to a local New South Wales inquiry, but also it led to, in large part, it led to the announcement. In fact, 10 years and one day ago, so it's a 10-year anniversary, essentially, of Julia Gillard announcing the Royal Commission into Institutional Child Abuse. And so that kicked off, in a sense, Detective Inspector Peter Fox's career as a whistleblower, and the rest is history, including a book that he wrote and released in 2019 called Walking Towards Thunder, the true story of a whistleblowing cop who took on corruption and the church. So, great to have you with us, Peter.
Pleasure to be with you, Robert and David.
So let's go back to the beginning and tell us all about it.
It's a bit of a journey. It still seems a little bit surreal in some ways because I joined the New South Wales Police Force as an 18-year-old all those years ago back in the 1970s, and I was very passionate about my career as a police officer, and it wasn't very long after I joined, I think some 15 months later, I left uniform duties and started training as a detective, and that's where I remained as a detective right through to the end of my career. But I grew up and was born down in Sydney. I housed the commissioner estate out in the western suburbs, and ultimately, after 5 years in Sydney, and I won't go too into depth, but the police force wasn't what I expected. It was the era of people like Roger Rogerson, and certainly being stationed at places like Central, Fairfield, and Newtown. It certainly opened my eyes to a lot of things that disagree with me. So much so that I actually remember contemplating resigning and leaving the police force. And it was my father's encouragement that I get out of the big smoke, so to speak, and I put in for a transfer to the country. And ultimately, that's what brought me to the Hunter Valley, and it was probably it was definitely the right decision that kept me in a police career.
Mm-hmm. Yes, rather than working the city.
Very much so. And I did find that moving to rural New South Wales, policing was very different. Unlike a lot of police in the big city, you weren't anonymous. There were only three detectives, including myself at Cessnock. And whatever you did, the community knew about it. But, I do reminisce a little bit. You were embraced also by the community. I ultimately met my wife, whilst at Cessnock. We raised our family there. My wife worked locally. Our kids went to school locally. They played in local sport. We all socialised in the community. And, you know, it does very much mean that you become embraced. And I found it an extremely different environment for Sydney. And certainly the ethics of the police were markedly so much higher than what I'd ever encountered in Sydney. And, yeah, so that's that brought us through. It wasn't probably, I moved around to a number of stations from Cessnock to Maitland, Singleton over the years. And it was after I was promoted to Detective Sergeant and transferred back to Cessnock that I first started to encounter child sexual abuse involving members of the Catholic clergy. The initial matter wasn't one that I was directly involved in, but it involved a now convicted priest by the name of Vince Ryan. Mm-hmm. He was a prolific predator. There's been a lot of documentation on his offences, but I think the fellow that was coming out that actually commenced his training in my office, Troy Grant, who some might not be aware, but he later on went on to a fairly long career in the police force and left and later on became the New South Wales Police Minister. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it was at that point that as he was coming out, speaking to me and getting statements of survivors, I became aware that much of this abuse, much of the rape of children had literally been going on in the Catholic Church, which was immediately behind my detective's office at Cessnock. And of course, that piqued a lot of interest in the community, and especially when he was charged. And there were attempts by various members of the clergy to conceal or avoid Vince Ryan being arrested. He was moved at the last minute from Cessnock to Taree. But nevertheless, he was arrested and has since served quite an extensive time in jail.
Mm-hmm. And how was it, how did it come to pass that your investigation and the evidence that came to your desk, so to speak, expanded beyond Vince Ryan himself to other priests, to in the diocese, to even outside of the Hunter region? How did it expand?
Well, in 2002, I was asked by a member of the DPP to start investigating another Catholic priest by the name of James Fletcher. At the same time, one of my other colleagues in my office, who I was one of my subordinates, was investigating another priest by the name of Dennis McLinden. Mm-hmm. By this point, alarm bells are starting to ring that, hang on, there's a fair bit of this going on, all involving Catholic priests in this area. And all these priests had fairly close links to each other, all in the same diocese, joining parishes, that sort of thing. Ultimately, I ended up charging Fletcher with a number of offences, he was convicted back in, I think, 2004. And he sadly passed away in jail. I say sadly, not from the loss, but for the fact that he didn't serve out his full sentence. He only served about 18 months or so before his demise. Mm. But the other priest was later on become an even bigger player in what later on went on, because Dennis McLinden was probably the worst of those three. Well, I say definitely the worst of those three clergy, in that the amount of victims that he preyed upon far surpassed the other two combined many times over. We didn't know it at that stage, but as we were closing in, and that is one of my colleagues, Mark Waters, was closing in to arrest him, the Catholic Church, unbeknownst to us, had got wind of it and purchased McLinden a one-way ticket to England. That wasn't disclosed, of course, to us. They portrayed themselves as trying to help, and they'd certainly let us know if when they were able to give us an address, because according to them, they had no idea where he was. Even though they were paying into his account, his stipend, you know, and it's a bit over the top to actually think that the Catholic Church doesn't know where one of their priests actually is. And, you know, as I said, it was many years later we discovered that it was, in fact, the diocese that purchased his ticket and had him fly out of Australia to flee our jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that all came to pass. And without going through every blow, ultimately he was snuck back into Australia, and he died just outside of Perth back in 2005. Uh-huh. Now, by 2010, a reporter in the Newcastle area by the name of Joanne McCarthy had also started to pick up on the disproportionately high number of Catholic clergy sexually abusing kids in the Hunter region. Mm-hmm. You know, I've only mentioned three, but the number far exceeded that. There was somewhere, I haven't sat down and added them up, but certainly in the region of 12, 15.
How many would there have been? I mean, 12 to 15, but what's out of a total of how many? You were one of only three detectives of your station in the region, and so how many priests are there?
Well, that's it. I've never sat down and actually divided up the Maitland Newcastle diocese. It's probably on a website somewhere, but I don't imagine that there would be that many parishes. You know, occasionally there are two people, priests at a parish, mm-hmm. but when you add up, 12 or 15 priests, it must have been at some point close to at least half, which is an absurdly high number.
Yes.
Yeah, and these were not just being investigated at Cessnock. I'm talking about police were certainly investigating them from Charlestown, which is down near Lake Macquarie, and certainly further up north, up the valley, the Upper Hunter to the Manning Valley, which is also incorporated in the Maitland Newcastle Diocese. But, yeah, certainly this amount of priests, you know, something was very wrong. You know, and you probably don't need me to tell you that when you've got those sort of statistics.
No, and not just wrong in sheer numbers of offender priests, but also in the actions of the church in, well, whisking Vince Ryan off to Taree. Did he have access to kids in Taree? I assume that he wasn't dispatched to a monastery to just contemplate and isolate him.
No, he was given a new parish there, and as to whether he had any victims there, I personally don't know, but it wouldn't surprise me. But yeah, so you had all these, and mind you, many of these priests were being convicted. You know, things running in the newspaper, and ultimately, I had a young detective that had worked under me, so it's not that I'd trained, and he came to me from Charlestown and saying that he asked my permission if he could access a couple of my my former briefs that where I'd started investigations on Dennis McAlinden, mm-hmm. but also James Fletcher, and he also wanted to have a look at the Vince Ryan matter, and he had independently started to put together the same thing that I and many others were, is that something wasn't quite right with this amount of clergy. And the church saying they had no idea what was going on. He was very keen to investigate these matters, and he actually came to where I was stationed then. By this time, I'd been moved to Raymond Terrace in the Port Stephens Command.
Right.
And I was by now a detective chief inspector. And Sean came back to me, and he was quite devastated in that he'd been directed to cease his investigation on that particular case, to hand it over and told the matter wouldn't be investigated. And that never sat well with Sean. He was quite distressed about it. At the same time, Sean had just charged another priest by the name of Father David O'Hearn, mm-hmm. who was in the Port Stephens Command. And at Nelson Bay. And, you know, he was very concerned that, you know, even though we were being, there was didn't seem to be any interference in investigating individual priests by police. Once we started to look at the next level up, that's where we started to encounter resistance. And through that whole process, Sean ended up going off on sick report, and sadly, he never came back to work. And a good detective was lost to the New South Wales Police Force. At that point, I was contacted by Joanne Powell, and she actually asked if I would pick up where Sean had left off. She wanted to see the diocese investigated for what she perceived was a systemic covering up of the crimes of these priests.
Yes, and hold that thought, because a number of intriguing questions come to mind. We'll go to a quick ad break. This is TNT.
You should hear what Jeremy Nell is talking about.
We keep hearing the term sustainable development. Now, that's a real thing, and there's no ways we can pretend it's not happening. So the best thing to do right now is to know what it is and then to buffer against it.
A lot of these terms like sustainable and, you know, resilient, saving the planet, and the way that the idea is pitched sounds very plausible and sounds something like we should be concerned about. And indeed we should. I mean, there are many aspects of what we're doing to the environment that we should be concerned about. You know, we are causing environmental damage with our industrial practices around the world. There's no doubt about that. And I think that's important to acknowledge. But sustainable development as it is pitched at the moment focuses very much upon the bogeyman of carbon dioxide in terms of CO2 emissions and the claimed need that we need to reduce CO2 emissions. The solution that is on offer at a globalist level hasn't really got anything to do with reducing carbon emissions. It's about a restructuring of the global economy and about the introduction of a new international monetary and financial system.
Jeremy Nell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Google and Facebook, they don't sell you anything. They sell you.
Facebook constantly manipulates their users. They do it by the things that they insert into the news feeds, and they do it by the types of posts they allow their users to see.
It's what Google and Facebook are doing on a regular basis, by suppressing stories, by steering us towards other stories rather than the stories we're actually seeking. That's the real manipulation that's going on.
I was a design ethicist at Google, where I studied how do you ethically steer people's thoughts.
It will always favor one online music service over another and one candidate over another.
Google and Facebook
has the power to undermine democracy without us knowing that democracy has been undermined.
There's what I call the creepy line, and the Google policy about a lot of these things is to get right up to the creepy line but not cross it.
Google crosses the creepy line every day.
Discover how society is manipulated by Google and Facebook. The creepy line at salemnow.com.
You're listening to McBride and Brennan with David McBride and Dr. Robert Brennan on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Yes, TNT, and this is our very special guest, former Detective Chief Inspector Peter Fox, who was a whistleblower whose investigations led in large part to the Royal Commission into Institutional Child Sexual Abuse that was announced by Julia Gillard 10 years and one day to today. So it's a 10-year anniversary. You know, and he's also the author of his essentially sort of a memoir of all the drama, Walking Towards Thunder, the true story of a whistleblowing cop who took on corruption in church. So, Peter, before I hand you over to David, who might have some questions, I'm seeing a sort of a speculative pattern emerge. Like Dennis McClendon, somehow the church got wind of your sniffing about and they whisk him away to England. How did he find out? How did the church find out? Then you've got your colleague Sean, whose case is shut down, and you're transferred to Raymond Terrace. Sort of a picture is emerging that of something beyond the church is trying to obstruct you.
Yes, well, I think Mac and Linden got wind of it through all the church did because of a number of avenues. One of them is that Detective Mark Waters started making inquiries, but prior to that, one of the women who, as a child, had been sexually abused by Mac and Linden had approached the church saying that she wanted something done. And we obviously heard that story repeated so many times at the Child Abuse Royal Commission. Approaching the church, she believed that they would do the right thing, like so many did, that they would help bring this perpetrator to justice. So unbeknownst to us at that time, they already had a heads up that something was going on, and she had intimated to them that she would be going to police. So alarm bells must have been ringing with them at that time. And, that was around the very same time, of course, that he was whisked out of the country. So, sadly, because of all that, he never ever faced justice in the courts here back in Australia. But ultimately, the cover-up of these crimes is what became very much the focus of my investigation in 2010. At that stage, we'd started to unravel much of this and started to look much more closely at it. What the real catalyst was, and two ladies that have given me permission, I've mentioned in their names in my book. Today, I'll just refer to them as Anthea and Denise, two sisters who had been sexually abused as children by Dennis Mac and Linden. Now, both these ladies had obviously grown up, they'd had families, and both of them had been registered nurses, and that was their career. And they had retired, and they had also, through various channels, got wind of the fact that Mac and Linden had not just sexually abused them, but many others. And they actually started to agitate for something to be done. They had done this back in the early to mid-90s by simply going to the church and, like many other survivors, expected the church to do the right thing. They expected that a police investigation would follow. They were brought in. One of the priests of the diocese, Philip Wilson, who's now deceased, had a tape-recorded interview with both women where they outlined what had happened to them. He had that typed up, and they signed statements, which he witnessed. And, of course, they're going, well, we'd only be doing this if this is going to become a police matter, which is what they were expecting. They didn't know that the church would ultimately, buy him plane tickets and allow him to flee jurisdiction. So if we scroll forward to 2010, these two women had, through a wonderful lady by the name of Helen Keevers, who had started working for the diocese in dealing with survivors of sexual abuse by its clergy, she'd managed to actually get copies of their original statements and provided that to these two women, and that's what really started to unravel things. When they went to journalist Joanne McCarthy, their statements were provided to Sean McLeod, Detective McLeod, who ultimately went off sick and didn't return. And then, of course, they were provided to me. And I contacted both Anthea and Denise, who came into my office, and I'd started typing up a statement from Denise. And it goes with, probably without saying that by this stage, Dennis Mac and Linden, the perpetrator, had died some 5 years earlier. There wasn't much we could do so far as prosecuting him for his crimes. But what was of interest is that these women had gone through a great deal of effort to actually try and bring him to justice through the church. Making statements, their dealings with numerous clergy, and that's what I was detailing in the statement of Denise. Denise lived in in Queensland, and was flying back the next day. And we got to the difficult part where she had to outline the details of what had happened to her as a child. And understandably, that's never ever easy for any abuse survivor. And she wanted to have a break, which, you know, is fair enough. That's, you know, most police understand that. So I said, well, that's fine. She was coming back down later that year and would finish her statement up. And the next statement when I organised the time was to get a statement off Anthea. But I'd also gone and got statements off a number of other people, in particular a school teacher that was aware of numerous victims of McAlinden, had also had dealings with the very same clergy in trying to get them to report him to police. Ultimately, his career was ended. He was a school teacher or school principal at Merriwell for the Catholic school up there. And ultimately, at the end of it, it finished his career when he tried to have something done. So his name was Mike Stanmore. Sadly, Mike passed away a bit earlier this year, but Mike gave a very concise statement with very intricate detail of all the efforts he'd made and effectively how the church had covered it all up and done nothing. What they simply did is, the same they did every time, is McAlinden was moved out of Merriwell and he was transferred down to Adamstown near Newcastle. And that, again, was some years earlier. So we had all these instances where, again and again, whether it was survivors or people like Mike Stanmore, tried to have the church do something about the sexual abuse of one of their clergy. And every time the church just moved him or hit him. So these people were now coming forward and I was obtaining their statements. But that's, I suppose, when things started to change. As I said, I'd had a fairly long career. I'd been in charge of many very high-profile cases over my years of service. Some of them featured in books and TV dramas, particularly in regard to some of the murders I've investigated. And at this point, I made a decision that I wasn't going to disclose what I was investigating to my my commanding officer. There were a number of reasons for that. He was a very devout Catholic, and I knew he was very close to the priest that had been charged by Sean McLeod. There were a number of other things that I won't go into today, but because of that, you know, I'd been around in Sydney and seen a fair bit happening down there at the early part of my career that I didn't like. And I thought, well, I'm going to continue to investigate this until I've basically got it all together and it's ready to go before I open up to some of those around me about what the nature of the investigation.
Particularly those who might have conflicts of interest, and yet it's interesting when you mention all these names. I'm thinking, well, there's good eggs in the Catholic Church too, and you've got. You've got your colleague Sean McLeod, that's a very Catholic Irish name. You've got good journalist Joanne McCarthy, very Catholic Irish name, and you've got that good teacher at the Catholic school who put his career on the line and ended up losing it. So you know, there are good eggs in the Catholic Church, and it seems that there's all of the players in this drama have the same kind of ethnic lineage and the same kind of, you know, religious lineage, even if they've left the church. I'm not presupposing to know the faiths of your former colleagues and that journalist. But, yeah, it's very interesting.
No, it is, and you are right. It is probably this part of the Hunter Valley, I suppose, you know, going right back in history, does have very strong connections to Earlish, British and Irish settlement, particularly in the convict era. The area is a very Catholic area, particularly around Maitland. And, you know, I certainly encountered many good clergy. You know, I'm not one of those that wants to throw them all into the one bucket, so because of the wrongdoing of some, that they're all bad. You know, one of those that was an absolute standout in my mind was Father Glenn Walsh, who breached some of the things that he should have been doing by coming into me and disclosing details that the church was most unhappy about, which in fact he told me that his bishop had told him specifically not to disclose it to police. So, yeah, as you said, there are some very good members of the Catholic Church that want to see change. But yeah, when I was making my investigations and put together a number of statements, I was due to go on holiday. I put it all together in a folder and I locked it all up in my safe. Now, this, I suppose, was the point where I realised things weren't all above board in what was transpiring. I ended up came back from leave, and one of the public servants came and see me, and in hushed tones she said, Pete, something was going on that I don't feel quite happy about when you're away. I've seen the two very senior police, a superintendent and a detective chief inspector from another station, go into my office, and she's seen them searching about and thought, what are they up to? And she confronted them and said, yeah, you know, Peter's on leave. The response was, do you know where he's put a brief on the these conducting into the Catholic Church? And she said, well, I didn't know he was even investigating that. But she said, why don't you ask him when he comes back where it is, rather than looking for it while he's not here? So when I've come back to work, I was told about this. And what surprised me is that neither of those two police came and confronted me or spoke to me about their searching my office for that brief. That fact made me feel very uneasy. I thought, what's going on here? I thought if it had been above board and legitimate, one of them would have came and said, listen, we're looking for that brief in your office while you're away for whatever reason, and disclosed it. That didn't occur, and that's not normal. I've never known a search like that to occur before. What further concerned me, and I'm aware that Detective Chief Inspector had previously had departmental convictions in relation to his unethical interference in a another serial child sexual abuse investigation where a number of statements had disappeared. And I think anyone that has got that in the back of their mind would become very uneasy. So it was that point I thought, I really do need to get this investigation moving and bring it to fruition. But before that happened, I was directed to attend the office of the superintendent at Newcastle, and whilst there, directed to hand over the investigation, all the statements, and directed to cease contact with any of the people that I'd taken statements from. This was, to my mind, quite extraordinary. I'd never encountered anything like this or heard of something like this in my career. And thinking back what had happened to Sean when he tried to investigate it, I thought, something's not right here. And, I didn't have much of a choice in a job, which is set up along the lines, as David was in with the military. When you're given orders from above, you've got to, follow those orders. And, I've had to hand that all over. I was far from happy with it. I did seek permission and was allowed one phone call to each of those people to explain that I'd been taken off the case, I'd been directed off it, and I was no longer allowed to contact them. That was very hard. It was quite distressing for those people. But ultimately that's what occurred. And it was almost 2 years later when nothing had ever evolved out of that investigation. It had been given to a relatively junior detective who'd only just returned to investigating. And not that he was incompetent, but certainly had not had the experience in those sorts of matters. And I thought, well, what is happening? And no one seemed to be wanting to have my input. I was very much held at arm's length from this investigation. And when I was told that it was unlikely that there would ever be any charges coming out of it, I already was aware of course, of what I put in the statements. And that's when I decided to go to the media. And initially, I wrote a letter to the Premier of New South Wales, expressing my concerns in an open letter. When I was told that he wouldn't be responding to it, that's when I made the decision to go on to the ABC Late Line program. And that was way back in 10 years ago, only a few days ago, back on the 8th of November 2012.
Another almost 10-year anniversary. We're going to go to a quick ad break, and then we'll hand you over to the lawyer's questions from David. This is TNT.
De-weaponizing weather with reality and perspective.
There's a great Bob Seger song that I love called Ship of Fools. If you get a chance, Google it and listen to it. And it's about a ship that was captained by people that were just out to destroy the ship. This is what's going on in Egypt right now with this meeting about climate change. What is so despicable about this is that if you actually look at how the atmosphere and the oceans work, the oceans have most of the energy. In fact, they have almost all of the energy. So why are you focusing on the atmosphere when the real driving mechanism is the ocean? The atmosphere is showing you the result of the cumulative energy between the ocean and the atmosphere. If the oceans have most of the energy, guess what the atmosphere is going to do? The research has to be on the oceans, and avoiding that should tell you a whole lot about what the captains of the Ship of Fools are up to. This is meteorologist Joe Bastardi, your climate and weather watchdog for TNT, asking you to enjoy the weather. It's the only weather you got.
Hi, my name is Marnie Dobek. I'm a family physician, and my son Zachary almost died of sepsis last year. We were lucky. Most people don't know the word sepsis, and they don't know the symptoms. Protect yourself and your loved ones. Know sepsis. To learn more about the symptoms, please go to sepsis.org.
You're with David McBride and Dr. Robert Brennan on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Yes, this is TNT, and our very special guest, former Detective Chief Inspector Peter Fox. David.
Well, look, I've been fascinated. I've just been listening. I always, I love to talk, as you know, but Peter Fox is one of those people, when he tells his story, it's just fascinating. I really think I was blown away by the magnitude of it, and I really felt for him when he was doing investigations and it got shut down, and also the idea, it's almost like it is a thriller, it's better than a Hollywood thriller, but if you didn't decide to I guess the question and it's similar to me, Peter, but you went on investigating, or you investigated and kept your boss out of the loop, so to speak, which I think is very brave, but it obviously was a very, very big problem. And then even then, you ended up getting closed down. I mean, you started off, obviously, even at the base level, these are pretty, very, very horrific things. But the idea that I had the same experience in my own issues, that the further you looked at the problem, you saw that it was much bigger than you first thought, and particularly the idea of getting it cleaned up. And one of the things, and again, I have the same thing in my own case, but the distinction between war crimes, which are bad, but cover-ups of those war crimes by their sort of leadership, which are much worse. I guess my question for Peter is just to sort of to draw out your focus, as you said, and this is an important one for people to remember, was on the diocese and how much the diocese was to blame in covering up. I mean, that is crucial. And you, Robert, ran through some very interesting stats, and it does read just if half the sort of priests had suspicion over them, I mean, the leadership of the church is made up of people who are formerly at the bottom. So you'd say at least half of the leadership would have, on those rough figures, would have had questions. Even some people in the police in leadership had question marks over getting illegally involved in investigations. I mean, that is, I guess you weren't going to give up, but it must have been very hard. How did it feel at that stage?
Well, David, it's just the frustration, I think, is what comes to mind. I don't want to sound like I've got tickets on myself, but I was a very competent investigator. I'd been given awards, and my investigative ability had been acknowledged. I was attending universities to give presentations on some of the murders and the forensic evidence, talking to doctors and academics, equally so going to courses at the police academy to help instruct other police. So it wasn't as if I hadn't been around and knew what I was doing. But, and that's why when you've got something so obvious in front of you and you're thinking, why am I being stopped? Why is this investigation being stopped? I haven't got all the answers. All I know is that's ultimately was the goal of what was being desired. And when I went on the Late Line program, in 2012, the interview I thought was primarily just going to be about child sexual abuse within the Catholic Church and calling again for a Child Abuse Royal Commission to be established. What the interviewer asked me about also was, I to this day, I don't know how he was aware that I've been removed from this other investigation, but when he asked me about it, I certainly didn't hesitate in telling him the truth about it, because that was quite disturbing in itself. And I suppose it was also very relevant as to why a Royal Commission was needed, because if law enforcement wasn't investigating these things properly, somebody needed to. Something else needed to happen. And what surprised me is the very next day, the Premier of New South Wales came out and said that he was establishing a special commission of inquiry into what I'd said, but not about the Catholic Church. The inquiry was all about the police side. My assertion that I'd been removed and unethical things were carrying on in the background. And many have said it before, and I certainly won't disagree with it. It really didn't become an inquiry. It actually became a trial where I was made to feel very much as if I was the one in the dock, facing the drama. But as I've already mentioned, even that inquiry, I'm the last one. Throughout my career, I used to dismiss things where people had conspiracy theories and I used to look for a logical explanation as to why things panned out. But as this special commission of inquiry got underway, I just became even more alarmed. I've always believed in our justice system, our rule of law, but what I was seeing here alarmed me. And, just by way of example, is the that particular investigation, as I mentioned, centered around two women, Anthea and Denise, whose statement of Denise I'd started, and Anthea's I hadn't quite commenced on, but I didn't see either of those women give evidence at the special commission. Now, to a logical person's mind, they're at the very centre of what I was wanting to investigate, yet neither of them appeared to give evidence. The affidavit that I'd typed up with all the background information, the commission refused to have it tendered. Yet the affidavits of every single police officer was tendered. And I'm thinking, this just doesn't feel right. I really feel like I'm being set up a bit here. And again, I want to reiterate, I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I don't want to sort of paint that picture every time. But what was going on here wasn't quite right. But then very important areas of my evidence, I was being directed by the commission that I wouldn't be permitted to give that evidence in public. That related to a police prosecutor trying to harbour a priest that I'd charged many years before, in that trying to keep it from the media and various other things, which is what alarmed me back then. But more so is the fact that the police that had searched my office, I gave very detailed, very express information. And, you know, I've spoken to numerous people in regard to the departmental convictions of one of those particular police. He's now very high ranking in the police force and still there, despite the fact that he has departmental convictions for unethical conduct in interfering in other investigations that he shouldn't have anything to do with, particularly in relation to child abuse. Now, when that was removed from my affidavit, it was just so frustrating, and I thought, this inquiry is not about the truth. The truth's not going to get out there. And ultimately, that's what ended up occurring. That commission came back and heavily criticised me, said I was a not a credible witness, which was very hard to take, and it effectively, of course, it ended my policing career, a career that I'd loved. But I suppose where I've got away, the impact on myself and my family was enormous. I'd always prided myself on my reputation, my integrity, and it seemed that, I was very much undermined by this inquiry. And it was a couple of years later, I was trying to put it all behind me, and absolutely out of the blue, I received a phone call from Denise in Queensland. Somehow she kept a number that I'd given her, and she said, listen, Anthea and I, I'm coming down to visit her in Newcastle. Any chance we could catch up for lunch? She said, there's something I want to talk to you about that commission. And, by this stage I was out of the police force. This is 2015. And, we had lunch together. Our partners came along and, while sitting down, Denise has then turned around and she said to me, Peter, do you know, when you were directed to hand that investigation over, that the police lost my statement? And my jaw dropped. I said, how can that happen? I said, why didn't they contact me? They would have known I've got the electronic copy of what I was typing. And she said, Peter, I think you know the explanation to that as well as what I do. She said, I knew when you were taken off the investigation that was it. It wasn't going anywhere. And, I'd harbored those thoughts deep down, but to be told this by one of these women really hit me. And I thought, well, no wonder we never saw either of them give evidence publicly from what she was telling me. And that's when a sister chimed in, and Anthea then said, they also told me that they'd lost Denise's statement. It wasn't just her they told me as well. And when I inquired when they told her, it was October 2010. And I pointed out, well, that's not possible, Anthea. They couldn't have told you that they'd lost it then, because I didn't hand it over until December 2010. And she said, I knew you wouldn't understand, but she said, they definitely told me. She said, here's a copy of an email I sent to four senior police in the police force. And when you read my email, you'll see what my concerns were. In it, she actually pointed out that the police had told her that they'd lost her sister's statement. Now, this was October 2010, and they don't get it to December. And then, in fact, they ring Denise up and say, we've lost it. Now, I'm sort of to this day still in disbelief that even occurred, that that's possible. But, here they were saying that they had serious reservations about what went on at that inquiry. And the more I read Anthea's email, she didn't just point that out, but she actually pointed out to them that the way that she was being treated by the police in the task force set up after I was removed made her feel as if they wanted to have a walk away and not pursue the investigation. And she actually outlined that in writing in this email. Now, she gave me a copy of the email, which I put away and I still have. Confirms the date on it and who she sent it to. But, the whole facts of it all. But what also disturbed me is that the Special Commission of Inquiry were also given a copy of this letter. But nowhere does it appear in their findings anywhere. And, so much of what was in that, of course, supported what I was saying. Yet publicly, that letter has never seen the light of day. Yet, the very inquiry that set up to get to the bottom of what happened had a copy of it. So, you walk away in disbelief because, as I said, I've never been one once to doubt our judicial system and what transpires. But it certainly took a lot away from me that day.
Yeah, no, that is very tough for me to listen to that. And what is interesting is the parallels between your story and my story are immense. The way that you became the problem, and you were effectively investigator, we were investigator, and we both know what a been called a witness of a not a reliable witness means, and that is outrageous. And as I said, you were very, very experienced, very well respected, as I was in my job. I didn't get to be the special forces lawyer without having a fantastic record, and I too was trashed. But yeah, I just love your story. I do think it is one of the great stories in Australia. Yeah, we remember in events like the Olympics and winning the America's Cup. But I think that having that Royal Commission into institutional child sexual abuse is one of those big, it's obviously it's a dark subject. The fact that it happened is something we need to celebrate in this country. We need to be able to look at the dark places because denying things doesn't make things any better. If we don't admit things and we don't look into them, we become less in ourselves as a society. And I think that is something, whether you get enough official praise for it or not, you really need to. I think you're an absolute hero, incredible story. And the pressure you must have come under, not just official, but psychological, in that the idea, like me, in the army, the idea that you work for the police, the institution that is meant to uphold the law and protect us, and you're still within your own element that was being shut down. And I think I saw that when the Royal Commission eventually happened, people like Tony Abbott and various other lobby groups, things that I can see were just lobbyists to say, oh, this shouldn't be just focused on one particular religion all this stuff, which sounds like lobbyist talk, because which doesn't make sense. It would be absolutely no problem investigating just the Roman Catholic Church or abuse there, and by all means go on and do the Anglicans later. I went to an Anglican school. There was abuse in my Anglican schools. But it's not good enough for people who are going to be accused of it or have an investigation. If you get an investigation, a bikie gang or something, it's not good enough for them to say, what about all the other gangs? You did very, that was clearly an attempt to shut it down. And it came, what I find most appalling about it is it came from people at the top. And I don't think this is over. I hope one day, if I'm successful in my own case and not in prison, and I do have, I hope that we can actually, because I think some of the, there's a lot of questions, there were a lot of things that really need to be reopened about cover-ups and pressure, that we, if we're going to be a righteous society in Australia, we really need to look into those things. It's not good enough to shut down investigations into serious things like that. They may prove not to be conclusive in the end, but we have to have the investigations, and you can't shut them down out of some sort of a sentimental attachment because you once knew a priest or you know a priest and you worry about it. We need to look into these things. But anyway,
well, David, that opens a whole new area, of course. And will they ever conduct an inquiry into what actually happens to whistleblowers? It's not something that we embarked upon as a career. We didn't see ourselves becoming a whistleblower, but you know, a lady at a whistleblowers organisation once said to me, you know, whenever somebody comes forward with something like this, those in power promote the message.
We'll have to have a part two, gentlemen. This is TNT, and join us for McBride and Brennan next week.